the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Sooner or later, we hope we'll be opening up the economy. The question is, if we do go back to work and offices open up, what are some of the issues that will be important? The legal issues, the things for health safety. Joining me on the program is Annie Ellis from Annie Ellis Law Firm. Annie, I want to begin about reopening the workplace, be an employer myself. What are some of the things that businesses will have to apply? And let's just make reference here to California, Cal OSHA. What are some of the issues that we need to talk about relating to injury and illness prevention?
This has been a really tough area for business owners to navigate, and my heart goes out to all of them, including you. So one of the first things that a business needs to reevaluate, first of all, can it open legally? Is it an essential sector, a non-essential sector? And that's a question you have to get answered by your state and or your county. So once you kind of make it past that threshold of whether or not you can even open, you got to make sure that your workplace has the written policies and procedures in place to cover all the COVID type issues. Are you set up for social distancing? My husband works at a biotech company where they've got 6,000 employees on campus in a bullpen environment. They can't reopen. They can't accommodate social distancing. If you're a retail or a restaurant, how are you going to do social distancing? Then the next step is you got to deal with the PPE, or the personal protective equipment. And the most common one, of course, is the face covering and the hand sanitizer and all the other things that come with having to do the cleaning procedures within the workplace. And once you figure out those types of issues, you have to put them all in a written policy. Not only do you have to do it legally out here in California because of our Cal OSHA, but you also have to do it for employee morale. They want to know the answers to these questions in writing before they set foot in your worksite.
You know, one of the things that we've done, because there was a brief period where we sort of went through alternate work schedules before they closed down again, we even had little devices you could wear around your neck that are air purification systems. We're putting in an ultraviolet antibacterial antivirus system through the air conditioning system. So we're taking that one extra step. Are there things that you could do, like what we're doing, that help with this?
I think anything that you can do that's above the bare minimum, and the bare minimum really comes down to daily shift screenings for COVID-type symptoms, the PPE that I just mentioned, and the social distancing, and making sure you're reporting positive COVID tests. That's really the bare minimum. But anything you can do beyond that, and you may have other requirements depending on your industry, I think is going to go a long way. I've been saying that it can cost a business, depending on the industry and the size of the business, upwards of six figures in order to comply, in order to reopen, especially if you're, take for example, a restaurant and the restrictions that are in there. So it's a cost investment. It's a time investment. You know, a light goes off and we flip a switch and say, great, you know, retailers can open today. That doesn't mean you're opening today. You need to plan, you know, two, three, even four, sometimes 5 weeks out. And also you got to order all this stuff. I don't know if you've ever been on Amazon in the recent days, but if you try to order any one of these things, it takes up to a month to get these things. And so I think that it not only helps from the employee morale perspective, but let's say you are one of those businesses that is visited by the health department, you can show, well, I've taken the extra step and here's what we've done.
Let's just say we've gone through all these steps, sanitizers, masks, social distancing, ultraviolet, and one of our employees gets COVID and they sue. How can they prove they got it at work if nobody else did?
Well, that is the million-dollar question these days, Jim. It's going to depend where you are. So here in California, our governor issued an executive order, and I think a lot of other states do this. So if you're in another state, check your state, that said that there's a presumption that testing positive, if you've been in the worksite for the last 14 days, is going to be covered by workers' compensation insurance. And even though the knee-jerk reaction might be, wow, that's crazy, I don't want that, I would rather have a workers' comp claim than a civil lawsuit, no question. Now, what's before Congress right now is the liability waiver. I'm sure you've seen a lot of buzz and noise about the HEALS Act and the HEROES Act. And one of the big distinctions between the two is whether or not businesses are going to get this liability waiver for that very issue. Now, I think if you're a business where you've had an outbreak, we have a restaurant here in town that I won't name names, but it's a national chain, so it's in most of the states, where they had a massive outbreak, where they had a high percentage of their employees testing positive. In that case, I don't think it would be tough to prove it came from your workplace. But if you're the one-off case and you're, you know, you're a 100-employee company and you have one employee test positive, I think that's unlikely to be able to prove that came from your work site. I was just actually talking to some business owners earlier this week where they were able to tie back this group of employees and their testing positive all to a July 4th holiday party. And we found pictures on social media. And so that was a great way for us to sort of, you know, beef up the file in the event there is a lawsuit. But really big question mark on what kind of liability we're facing, if it's workers' compensation or a complete immunity shield or nothing.
Annie, what about a situation of testing? I mean, can you require that your employees get tested returning to work? I mean, you know, every time I go by CVS, they got lines of cars for people getting free testing for COVID.
Yeah, that's been a big change in the last 30 days. So August 21st, 2020, which is today, as of right now, both the federal agencies, the CDC specifically, as well as our state agencies here in California have said that you can't require a negative test as a condition of returning back to work. That is a tough pill to swallow if you're an employer and you know that you've got someone with heavy symptoms and they're trying to get back to the workplace. All we're allowed to do right now is a symptoms-based analysis. And there's sort of this multi-step process you go through based on, you know, when the symptoms have come up, you know, the last time you took fever-inducing medication and other sorts of questionnaires. But that's been a tough one. And the reason behind passing that was, one, the tests are so unreliable right now. So requiring a negative test might hinder the employee's ability to return to work when they're fine. But two, the healthcare system's overloaded. So trying to get an appointment to get that kind of note has been causing a lot of delays with employees returning to work.
So, I mean, it's almost like a catch-22. So you can't ask or require it. But yet, if, let's say, you know, this person is coughing, sneezing, it looks like they have the symptoms. I mean, every time I walk into a doctor's office or at Scripps Clinic for my annual physical, there's somebody outside with the sign and they ask you, do you have any of these kind of symptoms? When you get inside, have you seen anybody? Have you been close to anybody with COVID? All those kind of questions. I mean, are we allowed to ask that?
Oh, we can definitely ask those questions and then we can take steps in response to that. So let's say, for example, we do find out an employee's spouse, for example, they've tested positive. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to require those daily shift screenings. Now this is for someone that has to report to a work site. Working remotely, of course, is completely different, but not every industry can be translated to a working remotely. And I was just going through this yesterday where we self-quarantined the employee and said, you either need to find a way to work remotely for the next couple of weeks. If you can't do that, then we're going to provide you with paid sick leave, because now there's a federal requirement to do that, to provide 2 weeks of paid sick leave in a situation like that where we've self-quarantined the employee.
So when I go to Scripps, there's somebody out in front and they've got this sign and they ask you every one of those questions. So it would not be unreasonable if you had, let's say our receptionist is on the front desk, somebody walks in to go to work, they ask that question. I mean, could we do something like that every day?
Yep. In fact, there's a requirement in some counties here in San Diego, there is a requirement where you have to do a daily shift screening. And that includes both third parties. So in your situation, that's the doctor's office example, because they're not employees, these are patients. But also in the employment context, where every day you have an employee show up to work, we're doing two things. We're taking their temperature and we're having them fill out a questionnaire answering those types of questions. Have you traveled? Have you been in contact? Have you exhibited any of these symptoms? And if they answer in a way that's yes to any of those, then what we're going to do is we're going to self-quarantine them. And it triggers all sorts of issues, of course. First of all, wage and hour. We got to pay them for the time that they spent, you know, answering those questions. And then what happens when you send them home? You have to pay them for that day as well. So it's a Pandora's box in a sense, but absolutely, not only should you, but in some cases, you might have to do that daily shift screening.
Let's say you've done all this, you've done all the things you need to do, sanitizers, screening, you've got the face mask, like in our case, we're putting in a filtration system. You do all those things. What else is missing?
It's communication. So you can hit all the legal requirements and you can be as compliant as you know, anyone. But the thing that I think a lot of businesses right now are missing are the transparency and the communication. How have you approached going back to your employees and saying, we're calling you back into the work site, we're bringing you back from furlough, and here's the procedures that we have in place. What mechanism do you have in place for them to raise their concerns? Or if they spot something that's not compliant, like, hey, I just saw my colleague without a face mask on. What the heck? How do I report that? And I think that that is almost more important than some of the technical compliance, because employees are human beings. They don't wake up and say, oh, I think my employer violated the government code today, I'm going to file a lawsuit. No, they get their feelings hurt. They feel like they're not being heard. It's an emotional component, and that's what creates lawsuits. So I view the transparency and the communication just as, if not more important than some of the other things.
Okay, so you do the communication. You make sure employees understand the policy. You're going through the questioning every single day, the screening. You do all those things. Let's say, God forbid, some employee gets COVID, obviously, they're not going to be coming into the office. What are the applicable laws, both federal and state, that apply once a person does get COVID?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that's been coming up a lot. So the Injury and Illness Prevention Program that we talked about earlier, the IIPP, that's your written COVID plan. And you've got to have something in there that addresses what to do in the event of someone testing positive in the workplace. But the first thing you do is you quarantine them. So they're no longer allowed to come to work. And if they're asymptomatic and they can work remotely, that's fine. But most likely they're going to be symptomatic, and we're going to have to put them on the federal paid sick leave, which is the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We have to give them paid leave for 2 weeks. So that's the employee. And then you work through that process that we just talked about when the symptoms subside and you go through the analysis, and that's making them back. Come back to work. But on the other front, you got to deal with everyone else in your workplace. So the first thing you need to do is evaluate, is has that employee come into quote unquote close contact with any other employees? And the CDC defines that as 6 feet or less for 15 minutes or more. So this, I'm getting this question a lot, which is, oh, a friend of a friend came by to my house and dropped off a package. Does that mean I've had close contact? No, it actually has a real legal definition. And then in that case, you need to notify those employees. And we can't reveal the identity of the person who's tested positive. We just have to tell them that someone's tested positive, they've been in close contact with them, and then we need to go encourage them to get tested and offer them that paid sick leave as well. And then the last component is cleaning the work site. So if they've been in the work site in the last, I think, 1 to 7 days, the CDC is changing their guidelines pretty regularly, then you have to go through this deep cleaning procedure. And those are really sort of the three steps that you got to deal with when you have someone test positive.
Let's talk about something else that we're going to be dealing with here. In fact, some in the country may be dealing with it right now, and that is going back to school. Some schools are not going to be opening. They're going to be doing distance learning. We're seeing the outbreaks at colleges that they're having to suspend live classes. One of the issues that this raises, Annie, in the environment that we live in today, where there's a two-income household, parents go to work, mom goes to work, and the kids go to school. What happens if kids don't go to school?
This is my biggest question and one of my biggest fears right now, Jim, that the employers that I work with are dealing with. And this is a federal requirement. So no matter which state in the land you're in, this is going to apply to you. So that Families First Coronavirus Response Act that I mentioned a couple minutes ago, that I said, well, that applies with, you know, someone's got a quarantine or they get sick, we got to give them 2 weeks of paid leave. It also qualifies if you're unable to work, whether on the work site or remotely, doesn't matter, because of school closure or childcare issues. And it's going to give you 12 weeks of paid leave. There's a certain cap, of course. And the impact of that is that it's a protected leave. It's FMLA type protected, which means you get guaranteed leave, guaranteed payment, guaranteed job reinstatement. You can take it full time. You can take it on an intermittent basis. So, hey, I need to do Mondays and Wednesdays. Well, you know, my significant other covers the rest of the days in the week. And so this is going to be a real practical issue for employers to face. Legally, it's not tough to comply with these requirements. They're not overly complicated. But what if 50% of your workforce can no longer work come September because they're doing virtual learning or distance learning for their kids? That to me is going to be such a gap in the workforce. And at a time when we've got obviously record high unemployment, I'm really concerned about how this is going to play out, because employers don't have the option to say, no, I can't give you that time off.
And then how does the business function? I mean, if you're a small business and you have key employees that you need or depend on, and all of a sudden they're saying, well, you know, under the law, you know, I don't have to come in. I need this time off. What does a business do?
So only certain businesses are covered by this new law, and it's businesses with 500 or fewer employees. So I say the Walmarts of the world aren't covered, so they're automatically out. But let's face it, most businesses don't have more than 500 employees. There is an exemption, a small business exemption, if you have 50 or less, but you have the burden to show that, and you run the risk of being wrong. And so that's one option, is a small business can say, well, I have 50 or fewer employees, and you have to go through this, you know, internal analysis of how it's going to impact your operations. So that's one route. The other route is some nonprofits might be able to qualify for a further exemption based on their nonprofit status. But short of that, I think that we're going to have to see employees and employers really talk to each other and work together and communicate and try to find a compromise or some sort of mutually agreeable solution, because this is going to be something that we all have to get through together. Now, of course, I'm hoping, you know, take, for example, San Diego, we're about to get off the watch list, that that's going to result in more in-person learning. And then maybe this issue won't be as big as we anticipated, but it's going to be something where the next 30 days are going to be really critical.
And let me ask you this. Let's go beyond school opening up. Let's say that by next year, they have a vaccine, they have some kind of medication. If you do get it, it can cure it. And hopefully we get back to normal. I'd hate to think that for the next 10, 15 years, we're all going to go to work with a mask on. Or if you're out in public, you have to wear a mask.
9/11 changed the way we traveled for the rest of our lives, right? But COVID is going to change everything else and travel for the rest of our lives. But I'd like to think that the masks or the face coverings are certainly not going to be a permanent requirement. I don't know if you've tried to fly recently. I just flew to the East Coast and it was wearing a mask for 12 hours. And my heart goes out to those healthcare workers that have to show up every day and wear a mask. But I'd like to think that we're going to have an ease up on the restrictions. One thing I'm seeing is a huge shift in flexibility, where employers before would say, no, you have to come to the worksite, you can't work remotely. That sort of era seems to have been eroded in the month of March and April earlier this year. We also have more flexibility on schedules, whereas before it was, no, you have to work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Now it seems to be more accommodating. So I think between those new philosophies going forward. And I do think we're going to have a vaccine next year. I'm hearing from a lot of the biotech companies, you know, around our town, which is a huge biotech town, that this is probably going to be around Q2 next year. And at that point, there's of course going to be the legal question of, can we require the vaccine before, you know, you come back to the workplace or before you travel or before insert anything here? And that's a question that I think the legislature is going to have to resolve.
Yeah, it just seems to me there's, you know, with federal mandates versus state mandates, there's some possible conflicts here. You can be in compliance with federal, but maybe not with state, or be in compliance with state and not with federal. There's so many conflicts for legal issues here. And I think that's what scares a lot of businesses.
Absolutely. It scares the lawyers too, because don't forget, we're trying to figure this out as it comes out. I mean, most of the stuff we did before COVID was, we had decades and decades of case law and interpretations and opinion letters to rely on. Now we're all just kind of figuring this out together. I think that the agencies, the first couple of months was rough in terms of the mismatch and the lack of consistency, but we're into August now. We're in what, month five, six of this, I think I've lost count. And I'm actually starting to see a lot more consistency. And the rule of thumb is you have to go with the one that's most stringent. So if your federal order is more relaxed than your state order, you got to follow your state order. If your county order is more stringent than your state order, you got to follow the county order. So for the most part, I think a lot of those inconsistencies have been resolved because you just pick the tougher one it is to follow. And that's the one that you have to abide by. But it is overwhelming to keep up with the sources of information between the various agencies. And so my job, you know, is working with business owners is to do that for them and to make sure that they have the information that they need when they need it. And that, you know, I'm filtering out what's actually most important.
So as we go through this, I mean, at least I don't know what it's like for you, Annie. I never thought in my entire adult life working career, I would see what we've seen in 2020. I mean, we've seen riots, we've seen anarchy in major cities, we've seen COVID. I mean, you know, I think somebody had a t-shirt, "I survived 2020," is when I think about this. You know, how do you see this changing a lot of things? In other words, okay, we had H1 virus a couple of years ago, we had Ebola, we've had all kinds of things. Do you think there will be building case law? So like, for example, who knows, 2 years from now or 3 years from now, there's something else that comes along that will be better able to handle it.
Well, I certainly hope that, you know, this is the worst that we see in our lifetime. I want to get that shirt that says "I survived 2020. Let me know where you got that. I know a lot of businesses that want to wipe 2020 just off their records, especially their P&Ls. But I do think that COVID is going to, it's going to change the legal landscape permanently. We've already seen some of those ways in terms of health and safety and written leave and paid time off requirements and the way we handle medical issues in the workplace. But the litigation that's going to come out of all of this, including employment law, but certainly not limited to, you've got insurance issues, that seems to be dominating things. I think that we're going to see a dramatically different landscape going forward. But I certainly hope that we don't have COVID 2.0. I mean, the H1N1 that we had, what was that, 10 years ago? I can't remember. Is nothing compared to this. The Great Recession feels like this is nothing compared to this. So I hope this is the end of the road on our lifetime.
In summing this up, if you could boil it down to step 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, what would you tell an employer that's thinking of reopening?
First, evaluate whether you can reopen. 2, brush up on the legal requirements to reopen, you know, the health and safety things. 3, put that into a written policy. 4, communicate that to your employees. And 5, have an enforcement mechanism. Make sure you've got a COVID supervisor or someone who's skilled and knowledgeable in this area to actually make sure that the implementation is there, because I can't tell you how many times I've seen great stuff in writing, but is it actually in actual practice once you get into the workplace? And I think if you do that, you're going to be in a really good position.
Annie, thanks so much for joining us on the program. If anybody here in San Diego or would like to contact you regarding these issues, how could they do so, please?
Just go onto my website, annieellislaw.com. There's a contact us tab, and you can shoot me an email or give me a call.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, Jim.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.